Here now from 89.3 WFPL. We love food. We love food television. Witness the Food Network and the Cooking Channel and PBS. And now this week, ABC's The Chew, which is debuted. We love reality contest shows. Witness the entirety of television, as a matter of fact. Food Network has debuted a new competition series. It's been out for a few weeks now called Extreme Chef. The extreme part is the conditions under which the contestants need to produce a great meal. What if you catered a wedding using just the ingredients from a 99-cent store? Or, and I'm going to read this, Marsh Mukhtari, this description from show number one. Three chefs arrive in an Old West ghost town where the competitors must gather rattlesnake meat in a burlap sack but have to make it past five hissing snakes to get there. Then they need to procure their ingredients from a broken-down chuck wagon and transport them via whiskey barrel through the muddy terrain. Then they are handcuffed for the last 10 minutes of cooking time. Then they cut open hay bales to find their ingredients and cook using only miner's tools and hot coals. Chopped, this is not.
No, no, this is not.
Now, Marsh Mukhtari is the host of Extreme Chef. He's traveled the world. He's played, you played American football.
I did,
which
yeah.
I want to talk with you about in the UK.
Yeah.
Along with rugby. You have hosted a number of series and specials, Nat Geo and History Channel, and now this. Why this?
I guess why not? I'm a huge food fan, and to put chefs through torture like this was kind of intriguing. So,
it's always amazing to me, and I suppose this is the case with any reality competition series, that there are people who are willing to put themselves through it in order to see maybe, you know, what they're made of, or whether they can actually win this thing.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I get asked this question a lot. There are other shows out there that that put chefs in their natural habitat, in the restaurant, in the kitchen. But what happens when you take them out of that habitat, and what happens when you throw curveballs at them and they still continue to perform? I mean, for example, John Tizar, he won the farm episode. We threw dust storms at him. Milk your own cow. I mean, just crazy, crazy stuff. And he still managed to put out this like three-layered lamb dish with tartare, carpaccio, and roasted lamb in this restaurant quality. It was absolutely shocking. And I think it just celebrates the chef in a different way. And it is entertaining. I mean, it's a crazy kind of show, but...
Well, and it's really just the extreme element of what the chef faces every day. This is live production in a kitchen. This is live production under the stress and duress of... Michael Rollman and others have written about it in books. It's 120 degrees in the kitchen or warmer. It's a hothouse environment. Things can go wrong. But the expectation is that there will always be a good product at the end. So I guess what you're doing is just pushing them right to the very edge.
Yeah, yeah, we're taking them to the limits. I mean, making them swim for a fish, making them, you know, climb up mountains and feed 12 hungry hikers. I mean, just crazy stuff. Anything you can think of, we've kind of thrown at them. And what never ceases to amaze me is the quality of the food and their integrity. Mm-hmm. The chefs all have the same kind of unwritten rule of I've always got to put out the best possible dish I can do. And for me, it was kind of intriguing. And I've always loved food. Like I said, it sort of breaks down barriers for me. And it's something that unites every human being on the planet. We all do it three or four times a day, hopefully. And it's a cool show.
Are you involved in the effort to put these shows together? And so that's not really, you don't have to sit down and figure out what these stunts are going to be.
No, unfortunately, I don't produce this show. I just, I'm a hired gun. I come in and host the show. And I kind of liken my role as I can't really say the word, but the stirrer of ceremonies. You know, I egg them on. I push them a little bit and try and get a reaction out of them. I've brought a couple of them to tears, which is great. I'm very proud of those moments.
Some of those moments make it to television.
Exactly.
Some don't.
They do. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
You came to television through a different kind of a route, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how that happened for you.
Yeah, it's kind of a crazy story. I've had a couple careers. Like you said, I played in the NFL. I was a wideout and a punt returner for the Scottish Claymores. And prior to that, I played rugby, and I have a degree in medical physics. And realizing I wasn't going to be the next Jerry Rice, I moved to London, and I happened to work in telcos. And very quickly after that, I moved into venture capital, private equity, and So I'm, you know, kind of living my life. And it was actually a pivotal day. I remember sitting on the underground, the tube in London, and looking across, and there was a probably in his 60s, 70s, gray-haired guy. He had exactly the same suit on as me. And I looked close, and I went, geez, you're wearing the same shirt. Oh, my God, that's me. Oh, and I just freaked out, and I actually, that day, this, I mean, sounds nuts, but I went and got a tattoo. I went on a sabbatical. I ended up in Australia, went around the world, and got a part in The Matrix Reloaded and Revolutions as an extra. And that was the first time I'd ever been on set. I'd never experienced the entertainment industry, and just the happiness. People were smiling. I'd never experienced that in a workplace before. I didn't know what to make of it, but I knew I needed to focus on this little whim. Mm-hmm. On my travels, I met my wife, who's a creative director and works in advertising, and she kind of encouraged the reading, writing, the painting. I think I was just ripe to meet a creative girl, and I'm happy to say now we have two children. We live in LA, and I put myself through acting school. I had to focus on this little whim, and that's kind of how I ended up in the industry.
But your career also includes, I would call it fairly documentary work. Some of the Dead Road, is that Deadly?
Yeah, Death Road was a special I did on History Channel.
And, right, and then Perilous Journeys, which was, that's Nat Geo.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I've seen some of that. That's really amazing work. That's really on the level of public television quality. I mean, it's the National Geographic, really highly produced documentary series.
Well, thanks for watching it. And you know, it's been, for me, it's I like to sum it up as unexplored places and unspoken to people. I mean, these are little gems that exist all over the world. And I applaud you for doing this kind of work and talking to people about, you know, the reefs that are dying in the world, because these matters are important. And to go and drive a scary road and kind of tell you what it's like, you can kind of live vicariously through some of the exploits that I've been on. And it's so much fun. I mean, God, I get to go to the Himalayas, the Arctic, Africa, Bolivia. I mean, really incredible places and really beautiful people. I mean, in Panama, for example, I was in the Darien Gap meeting Umbera tribes people. I didn't even know they existed. That, you know, mm-hmm. You're talking breasts out and loincloths on the men, and you're like, what? I'm the first white person that has ever been to your tribe. I didn't know that existed, and apart from deep, deep in the Amazon, but it's in Panama. Shocking.
Well, and you have a kind of an international history, if I remember right. Growing up, you grew up outside the U.S. and outside the U.K., Iran.
That's right, yeah. I'm half Iranian, half English. Mm-hmm. My mother and father met while my dad was on a navigational degree in the U.K., and I lived 7 years in Iran. Was born in the UK, and very, very quickly after, we went to a gorgeous part of Iran. Right in the top of the Persian Gulf is a small island called Karg Island. Mm. So I lived my first 7 years there, and every day was, I don't know, what are we going to do? Well, let's go to the beach and bathe in the beautiful waters. And Iran is a gorgeous, stunning country. Unfortunately, more recently, you know, they had a civil war. Iran-Iraq went off, and religious fanatics have kind of taken over, and it's really sad what has happened to such a great, beautiful country. And there are really still to this day wonderful people, you know, incredible poets, writers, filmmakers, and it's a travesty what's happening to that country right now. But
right.
I still have kind of a feeling of warmth and beautiful people and beautiful culture and history of Persia, the Persian Empire. That's why a lot of Iranians call themselves Persians, because we like to associate ourselves with that glorious history. But yeah, I lived Iran after the exploding missiles of civil war. I ended up in the UK, and that's where I did most of my schooling. And I lived in Australia for a year doing that fun stuff. And now I'm happily living in America, and I'm now a citizen.